Everybody is curious about the future. I mean, that's obvious. All of us are. For one reason or another, we would like to see ahead. We would like to know what we don't know. Almost anybody would like to know how it's going to be in their life in the future. The Jews of Jesus' day were no different. They wanted to know the future too.
Scripture says that only God knows the hour of Christ's return, but you can know how to prepare for his return, as well as know what exactly will happen when he comes back. You'll start digging into those details as John MacArthur begins a study today on Grace to You, titled Jesus is Coming. John, there are lots of people who sort of avoid the subject that we're dealing with, the second coming, future events. They say, look, I'm concerned about here and now, and as if that's somehow noble in a way that studying Bible prophecy is not. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, what jumps into my mind immediately, Phil, is when I was in the eastern part of the former Soviet Union. I was way back deep into Kazakhstan in Almaty, and it was the first pastors' conference in Central Asia in history. Hmm. And there was a church that actually seated 1,600 people, and it was packed to the gills, standing room only, with these pastors. For the first time, they had a pastors' conference in Central Asia after the Russian Federation broke up. And they asked me basically to teach on the church. And a couple of days into this, the leaders came to me and said, when are you going to get to the good part? And I said, what do you mean the good part? They said, when are you going to get to the coming of the Lord in heaven? Hmm. There was nothing in this world that they were clinging to. And so their hope for heaven and the coming of Christ burned bright. And I remember I said, okay, I'll take one whole day. And I took one entire day and went through the whole eschatology of the New Testament and all that was connected to the coming of Christ. And at the end of the day, they were so thrilled. And they said, you believe exactly what we believe. And it struck me that they had an accurate eschatology without education, because all they had was the Bible. To get it wrong, you have to go to some school where they get it wrong and they teach you to believe wrongly. So that has stuck with me my whole life since then, that all that mattered to them was what the Lord had for them in the future, because there was nothing in this life actually to hold on to. Mm. You know, we live in such an affluent world that there's so many things that basically draw our desires and our affections, and we connect with these worldly things and we don't want to give them up. And we'd like you to rethink the coming of Christ and how central that should be. We ought to be living for his return. We ought to be looking for the glorious appearing of the Lord Jesus Christ. And we're going to help you to do that as we explore Matthew 24.
So how should what the Bible says about the future change the way you live today? That may be the most important question this study will answer for you. And here's John now to launch his series titled Jesus is Coming.
Everybody is curious about the future. I mean, that's obvious. All of us are. For one reason or another, we would like to see ahead. We would like to know what we don't know. Almost anybody would like to know how it's going to be in their life in the future. And there are people who would like to know what's going to happen in the economy so they can make the right investments. There are many reasons for wanting to understand the future, and so man has always sought to understand what is not known about the future. There's a pull to understand that. The preoccupation with future things is not only limited to those who study the Bible by any means. Throughout all of human history, religion to religion, there have been seers and prophets and prognosticators and witch doctors and mediums and futurists, fortune tellers, religious leaders, and all kinds of people who've always been trying to take a leap into the future, as it were, and get a picture of what's happening there and then report back so folks can better handle the present by understanding something of the future. The Jews of Jesus' day were no different. They wanted to know the future too, and they had their reasons. I mean, they were tired of being oppressed. They were tired of being under the thumb of some controlling nation. They were, in every sense, a noble people, and still are. The Jewish line of humanity is indeed a noble line of people. They are not a people who don't have what it takes to be autonomous. They are not a people who can't rule themselves and create their own meaningful society and make contributions. They really don't need to be subjects of someone else, but that's exactly where history has found them for most of their life. And so by the time you come to the time of Jesus, they are anxious to see the cessation of oppression which has plagued them throughout all the time period which the Bible calls the times of the Gentiles up to that point. They long also to see the coming of their Messiah, because they know when Messiah comes, He'll make things right. He'll throw over the oppressors. He'll settle the issues that need to be settled, and He'll establish again the kingdom in Israel, and things will be the way that God promised they would be and should be. And so they're filled with eschatological anticipation. Eschatological comes from the word eschatos in Greek, which means the last things. So it's the study of the last things. And the Jews were really into the last things. They had had enough of all of the difficulty. They had experienced Assyrian oppression in the taking away of the 10 tribes from the north. They had experienced the Babylonian captivity in the taking away of the southern kingdom, Judah. They had gone through the Persian rule and the Greek rule and now the Roman oppression, and they'd had enough of all of that. And in their spirits, as they articulated in John 8 to Jesus, they were never servant to any man. They were looking for the day when they would be free again, and they would be ruled again by a righteous king, and they would know the kingdom God had promised them with the flourishing of all of its benedictions and blessings promised in the Old Testament. And they read the Old Testament, and they knew the Old Testament talked about a bright and hopeful future. They knew the Old Testament talked about God setting up a kingdom. They knew they were to anticipate an anointed one, a king, a Messiah, or in the Greek, a Christ, who would come and establish the rule and reign of David again on the earth. And they longed for that to come, a time when righteousness and peace prevailed, a time when Jerusalem dwelled in prosperity and safety, and not only for a brief time, but forever and ever, as the prophet Isaiah had told them. They longed to see that day when the restoration of the kingdom was given as God had promised it would be given. And so they were filled with hope for the future. And no doubt they read with relish the Old Testament prophets. No doubt they exulted as they anticipated what Isaiah said in chapter 9, when he said there would come one, the government of the world would be upon his shoulders, and he would rule and reign. He would be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Father of Eternity, Prince of Peace, and of the increase of His government and peace, there would be no end upon the throne of His father David to order and establish it forever and ever with justice and so forth. They really understood that. They thrilled at that. They must have read Isaiah 11:1, that there would come a branch out of the root of Jesse, who was the father of David, another like unto David, not David, but one like David, a king like David, who would reign in a prosperous time. And this particular one like David, it says in Isaiah 11:2, would be anointed with the sevenfold power of the Holy Spirit. And as you flow through that 11th chapter, they must have read it many times and saw all of the things that were yet to come. And they must have read as well Jeremiah chapter 23, chapter 30, and read about how that there would come one who would sit upon the throne of his father David and reign and rule, and Israel would be again the flower that it should have been, blooming in full bloom and full glory under the blessing of God. And they must have read Zechariah, because Zechariah talks about that particularly in chapter 14. And surely they knew Daniel. And they must have known that in Daniel there was the promise of great holocaust at the end, but that holocaust wouldn't be the end, because there would come a stone cut out without hands that would establish an eternal kingdom on the earth. They were well aware of what the prophets had to say. And so by the time you come to the life of Jesus, there is a very, very clear scenario of eschatological events in the mind of the Jew. And they had basically taken the Old Testament teaching from Daniel and Zechariah and Isaiah and Jeremiah, and they had framed it together with the teaching of Ezekiel to give them a whole flow of how it would be in the end. And we see this eschatology coming through the writings of that time period. If you read the non-biblical writings around the time of Christ, they give us insight into the thinking of the Jews of that time. This is very important as background to our text. What did the Jews think? was going to be the end of the age? What did they think was going to be the coming of the Son of Man or the Christ? What did they think the judgment was going to be like? What are the events they anticipated? Let me see if I can't draw you to a source that'll outline this for you. This, to me, is a very fascinating point. A man by the name of Scherer, S-C-H-U-R-E-R, wrote a book entitled The History of the Jewish People in the Time of Christ. This man, who has no particular eschatological view to champion, at least certainly not the view that we would hold, tells us what it was that the Jews believed in that time. And it's most fascinating. And he draws it out of their contemporary literature as to what they were writing. Let me give you the sequence. First of all, Scherer says the Jews believed that before the Messiah came, there would be a time of terrible tribulation. So that before the Messiah arrives, there would be a time of birth pain. As a woman has birth pain immediately before life comes out of her womb, so before the kingdom of Messiah is established, the nation will suffer some tribulation, some pain. Now, they could have understood that simply by reading the 14th chapter of Zechariah, because in effect, that's exactly what it says there. And we see that that's where their thinking was by reading, for example, the second book of Baruch, in which it says, "And honor shall be turned into shame, and strength humiliated into contempt, and beauty shall become ugliness, and envy shall rise in those who had not thought aught of themselves, and passion shall seize him that is peaceful, and many shall be stirred up in anger to injure many, and they shall rouse up armies in order to shed blood, and in the end they shall perish together with them." So they anticipated a time of terrible breakdown of morals, a time when honor and decency would be torn down, a time when the world would become warlike and there would be a physical moral chaos in the world, and this would be the birth pain about to bring the Messiah. In 4th Ezra, another one of their books that tells us what they were thinking, it says there will be earthquakes, tumult of peoples, schemings of nations, confusion of leaders, and the disquietude of princes. Furthermore, in the Sibylline oracles, it says, "From heaven shall fall fiery swords down to the earth. Lights shall come, bright and great, flashing into the midst of men. And earth, the universal mother, shall shake in these days at the hand of the Eternal. And the fishes of the sea and the beasts of the earth and the countless tribes of flying things and all the souls of men in every sea shall shudder at the presence of the Eternal, and there shall be panic. And the towering mountain peaks and the hills of the giants he shall rend, and the murky abyss shall be visible to all. And the high ravines and the lofty mountains shall be full of dead bodies, and rocks shall flow with blood, and each torrent shall flood the plain, and God shall judge all with war and the sword, and there shall be brimstone from heaven, yea, stones and rain and hail incessant and grievous, and death shall be on the four-footed beast, yea, the land itself shall drink of the blood of the perishing, and beasts shall eat of their fill of flesh." Now, if you didn't know better, you'd think this guy had been reading the book of Revelation, but it hadn't been written yet. They saw a future time of tremendous turmoil, tribulation across the world. In fact, they anticipate in the Mishnah that arrogance increases, ambition shoots up, and the vine yields fruit, yet wine is scarce. The government turns to heresy. There is no instruction. The synagogue is devoted to lewdness. Galilee is destroyed. Gablon laid waste. The inhabitants of a district go from city to city without finding compassion. The wisdom of the learned is hated. The godly is despised. Truth is absent. Boys insult old men. Old men stand in the presence of children. The son depreciates the father. The daughter rebels against the mother. The daughter-in-law against the mother-in-law. And a man's enemies are his house fellows. End quote. That's out of the Mishnah. Now, they didn't know it, but they were premillennialists. They anticipated the tribulation. So the time which preceded the coming of Messiah was to be a time of turmoil around the world. The second thing that they had in their eschatology was that into this turmoil would come a forerunner and a herald announcing the immediate arrival of the Messiah, and he would be like Elijah. As the Messiah is not David, but like David, so the forerunner is not Elijah, but like Elijah. as the king himself comes in the spirit, as it were, and the power of David, even to a greater extent, so the forerunner comes in the spirit and power of Elijah to even a greater extent. And so they anticipated that one like Elijah would come. That's why they were so drawn initially to John the Baptist, because he was so much like Elijah. And John the Baptist would have been that Elijah fulfilling that prophecy if they had received Jesus Christ and his kingdom. But because they rejected him and the kingdom was postponed, therefore there has to be another like Elijah coming prior to the second coming of the king. And so the Jews, not necessarily seeing all of that I've just said to you, did see there would come one like an Elijah who would announce the coming of Messiah. In fact, the Jewish oral law laid it down that money and property, the ownership of which was disputed, or anything found whose owner was unknown, must wait, quote, until Elijah comes, because he would set everything right to ready everyone for the Messiah. The next thing they saw was the coming of Messiah. First a tribulation time, then a herald, and then the coming of Messiah himself, the one who was the king, the great divine figure who would come and end the present age and establish the age of glory, the kingdom, and vindicate God's people. The next thing they saw in their eschatology, according to Scherer, is that the nations would ally themselves and gather to fight against the Messiah. Amazing. For example, in the Sibylline oracles again, we read this Jewish teaching. The kings of the nations shall throw themselves against this land, bringing retribution on themselves. They shall seek to ravage the shrine of the mighty God and of the noblest men whensoever they come to the land. In a ring round the city, the accursed king shall place each one his throne with his infidel people by him. And then with a mighty voice, God shall speak unto all the undisciplined, empty-minded people, and judgment shall come upon them from the mighty God, and all shall perish at the hand of the eternal. He sees all the nations gathered in Jerusalem or around it, all the nations gathered in Israel to fight against God. They stick up their own gods with all their people around them, and in the midst of all of that effort to fight against God, God destroys them all. And in 4th Ezra it says, it shall be that when all the nations hear this, the Messiah's voice, every man shall leave his own land and the warfare they have one against the other, and an innumerable multitude shall be gathered together desiring to fight against him. All the other wars will stop and everybody will go to fight against the Messiah. Now again, this was the Jewish belief at the time of Christ, according to Scherer, and it's exactly what the Bible teaches. Exactly what we understand from the Old Testament prophets and from the book of Revelation as well. Now that takes us to the next thing that they taught in their eschatology, and that is that the result of that battle against the Messiah would be total destruction of all these nations. There would be a total devastation of the nations that oppose Messiah. In fact, Philo said the Messiah would, quote, take the field and make war and destroy great and populous nations, end quote. And in 4 Ezra, again, it says, he shall reprove them for their ungodliness, rebuke them for their unrighteousness, reproach them to their faces with their treacheries, and when he has rebuked them, he will destroy them. And in Enoch, it says, and it will come to pass in those days that none shall be saved, either by gold or by silver. None shall be able to escape. There shall be no iron for war. No one can clothe himself with a breastplate. Bronze shall be of no service, and tin shall not be esteemed, and lead shall not be desired, and all things shall be destroyed from the surface of the earth. In other words, he'll come and destroy all the hostile nations so that their armor and all the things they use to protect themselves are utterly useless. Now remember, I'm not giving you premillennial contemporary dispensational viewpoints. This is a look at Israel at the time of Christ. They saw tribulation coming, then comes the Messiah after having been heralded by his forerunner. When he comes, he is fought against by the nations whom he defeats in a devastating way. Then they believed the next event would be the renovation of Jerusalem. There would be a wholesale renovation of Jerusalem. This would be the purification of that city, so that it would be the Jerusalem of the great millennium, the Jerusalem of the great kingdom, the Jerusalem of the great eternal glory of the king. In fact, in Enoch, it says, the book of Enoch, all the pillars were new and the ornaments larger than those of the first Jerusalem, as it were. It says, so they saw this renovating of the whole of Jerusalem. The next event they saw was that the dispersed Jews who'd been scattered all over the world would be collected back. They'd be regathered back into the city of Jerusalem. In fact, to this day, the Jewish daily prayer says this, in part, quote, lift up a banner to gather our dispersed and assemble us from the four ends of the earth, end quote. That's part of the daily Jewish prayer. They look for the day when Messiah comes, defeats all these nations, renovates Jerusalem, and then regathers all the Jews from all over the world. In fact, in the Psalms of Solomon, it is written, "Blow ye in Zion on the trumpet to summon the saints. Cause ye to be heard in Jerusalem the voice of him that bringeth good tidings. For God hath had pity on Israel in visiting them. Stand on the height, O Jerusalem, and behold thy children from the east and the west, gathered together by the Lord. From the north they come in the gladness of their God. From the isles afar off God hath gathered them. High mountains hath he abased into a plain for them. The hills fled at their entrance. The woods gave them shelter as they passed by. Every sweet-smelling tree God caused to spring up for them, that Israel might pass by in the visitation of the glory of their God. Put on, O Jerusalem, thy glorious garments. Make ready thy holy robe, for God hath spoken good for Israel forever and ever. Let the Lord do what he has spoken concerning Israel and Jerusalem. Let the Lord raise up Israel by his glorious name. The mercy of the Lord be upon Israel forever and ever," end quote. So they see God coming and collecting everybody and bringing them back to a glorified Jerusalem. This was their dream. This was what they anticipated on the basis of the Old Testament prophets. The point is, they understood the Old Testament prophets the same way we do. We understand the same sequence. People say, well, if you're premillennial, if you believe in the premillennial viewpoint, you believe that Christ is going to return after a time of tribulation to set up his kingdom on the earth, this is something new. This isn't anything new. This is understanding the Old Testament prophets exactly the way the Jews of Jesus' time understood them. And then after that, they believe Palestine will become the center of the world. That was the Jewish belief. Palestine would become the center of everything. The whole world would be subject to it. All the nations would be subdued, and the nations would come to Jerusalem to worship the king. In fact, in the Sibylline oracles again, all the isles and the cities shall say, "How doth the Eternal love those men," speaking of the Jews, "for all things work in sympathy with them and help them. Come, let us all fall upon the earth and supplicate the Eternal King, the mighty everlasting God. Let us make procession to his temple, for he is the sole potentate." So they believed that the whole world was going to come subject to the Messiah and come to Jerusalem to worship that God. And finally, the last point in this little eschatological flow was that there would come a new age of peace and goodness and glory that would last forever. Now, in that we see the eschatological viewpoint of the Jews of the time of Jesus. They believed there would come a time of tribulation, a time of difficulty, a time of trouble. And then there would come a herald to announce the coming of Messiah. And then there would come the Messiah. And when the Messiah came, the nations of the earth would gather to fight against him, and he would devastate and destroy them. And then he would purify the city of Jerusalem. Follow this very carefully. Purify the city of Jerusalem, gather together the Jews from all over the earth, and establish his eternal kingdom. That was Jewish eschatology. Now follow their thinking. They had been under tribulation from their viewpoint for a long time, right? I mean, they'd been under it. Persians, Greeks, and now Romans. And they looked at the Roman oppression as a time of tribulation, a time of difficulty. And they could easily remember back not long before when their people had suffered in the Maccabean period the terrible desecrations by Antiochus Epiphanes and the Greeks. And so they may have well thought the tribulation was already going on, that the Roman oppression under which they now existed was in fact that. And then shows up John the Baptist. What do you think they think now? Here's the one like who? Elijah. And then all of a sudden comes Jesus Christ, and he heals people, and he raises the dead, and he has this amazing power to feed multitudes. And he's a wonder worker, a miracle worker who banishes disease from Palestine during the duration of his ministry. And he comes riding into Jerusalem at the Passover, and they throw palm branches and garments in front of him, and they say to themselves, "This is it. This is the Messiah." And they remember, what is the first thing that's going to happen when the Messiah comes? Ooh, the first thing that's going to happen is the nations of the earth are going to gather against him, and he's going to destroy them. And so they immediately think he's going to start a war, and the Romans are going to be the first ones to get it, and the Holocaust ought to start real fast. And once he's done that, then he's going to purify Jerusalem. Then he's going to throw out all the hypocrites and all the false religion and all the false worship. And then we're going to see that glorious, maybe they thought of the Ezekiel temple of 40 to 48 in Ezekiel, that glorious final temple where the true worship is going to go on. And then he's going to gather all the Jews from all over the world and establish the eternal kingdom. Now you know what's in the head of the disciples as we approach chapter 24, okay? This is the kind of thinking that's going on in their minds. And the scene is unfolding so clearly, it seems to them. You say, well, what about when Jesus told them that he was going to die? When even on the day of the triumphal entry, he said to them, unless a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abides alone. What about that? Does not compute. Is not in their eschatological scenario. They can't handle that. That they reject that. And they're always saying, no, 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 that can't happen. So they do not comprehend the death of Christ. They do not apprehend the resurrection of Christ. They only see the coming glory, see. And they have a very compressed view of Christ. They see it all happening when he comes the first time. They don't understand what we understand. He came once, and now we got a long time period, right? Until he comes again. The Old Testament prophets didn't see that. They didn't talk about that. They just saw Christ coming and the whole thing happening. They didn't see the time element in there. That's why we call that a mystery, because it was not revealed in the Old Testament. In fact, Paul calls the whole New Testament a mystery hidden from ages past, because it unfolds a time period not seen previously. Mystery meaning that which was hidden. So the Old Testament prophet saw it all happening at one time, and that's the way the disciples saw it. So they expected, boy, it's right on schedule. Our eschatology was on target. We rightly interpreted the Old Testament prophets. We have been through the tribulation in our own experience. We've seen the Elijah come in John the Baptist. Here is Christ the Messiah. He's coming into the city. He accepts our hallelujahs and our triumphal praises. And he's going to, first of all, take on the whole Gentile world in the day of the Gentile, purify the temple, gather the Jews, and establish his kingdom. It's all on time, all on target.
This is Grace to You with John MacArthur. Thanks for being with us. Today, John launched a study that's showing you what the future will be like. He's titled this look at end times events, Jesus is Coming. It's a series that can motivate you right now to reject sin, pursue righteousness, and evangelize the lost, to make the most of each day, since you don't know when Christ will return. Now, friend, remember, we make it easy for you to review the teaching you hear on Grace to You. Jesus is Coming is available in CD, MP3, or transcript format. To get your copy, contact us today. To give these messages to a friend, I would encourage you to pick up the 9-CD album. It's affordably priced, shipping is free. To order, call 800-55-GRACE. Or place your order at our website, gty.org. For the MP3 recordings or transcripts, go to our website, gty.org. Those are free to download. And the title again to look for, Jesus is Coming. And for MP3s or transcripts, remember, we have them for all of John's sermons, 3,500 total, and all of them are free of charge at gty.org. Also, when you contact us, ask about the MacArthur Study Bible. It has nearly 25,000 footnotes that can help you understand Scripture like you never have before. From the prophecies about Jesus' first coming to the prophecies about his second coming, from Genesis to Revelation, and every passage in between. Place your order at gty.org or call us at 800-55-GRACE. Now for John MacArthur, this is Phil Johnson, encouraging you to be here tomorrow when John continues his study of Christ's future return and how you can prepare for it. Join us for another half hour of Unleashing God's Truth, one verse at a time, on Friday's Grace to You.